time to host our monthly book club. And to do that, I'm joined by award-winning novelist Adele Parks. Afternoon, Adele.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Lovely to be here. Yeah, brilliant.
The book up for discussion this afternoon is Head of State, written by Andrew Marr. And this is Andrew's first work of fiction.
It is. I mean, he's obviously incredibly well known for his stunning historical books and all his journalistic work. But yes, first work of fiction. So he is a debut novelist.
And he subtitled this book A Political Entertainment. And I certainly found it to be that. I'm very pleased to say Andrew actually joins us on the line now. Afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Very welcome. Delighted to be.
I imagine a lot of people in the world of politics were probably quite nervous when they heard you were going to write a novel.
Well, they knew that there were squadrons of libel lawyers waiting in the rings already, so they probably weren't that nervous.
Had to be a little bit careful.
Had to be a bit careful. Most of the characters here are based on real people, but are mash-ups of people, combinations of people and so forth. They're not actual characters that you can stop in the street. Some of them are, not many.
Although some of them, Nelson Fraser, for example, I wonder who that could be.
yeah, Fraser Nelson. I did have games with people's names and so forth a lot.
Did you have to talk to them in advance or get any? Did you care? Did you try and get any clearance?
Rory Bremner plays a significant role in the book, and so I told him and sent him the pages about him, and he was perfectly happy with that.
I really enjoyed that, though. I don't know about you, Adele. I loved kind of spotting the names that we do know, and also then trying to draw parallels between characters and people in real life. Did you use the book, Andrew, to settle any scores
you
at all?
You bet I did. Absolutely.
I love the bit about Dominic Sandbrook.
Yeah.
Wicked.
Well, little so-and-so, he deserved it, I thought. no, it's not serious in the sense I'm not boiling with anger and trying to do people in, but if people have fun with at my expense, I reserve the right to answer back a bit. You know, there is a kind of serious element to this. It's the surreal and fast-moving and almost impossible-to-believe political world which I live in and inhabit and write about. And this was an attempt to start to describe it in ways that I can't do as a journalist.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about the plot. I mean, you very generously say that actually the idea for the book was given to you by somebody else.
Yes, a chap who's now called Lord Chadlington. He's one of the Gummer dynasty, political dynasty. And he's basically a PR man who, in John Major's government, was working in Number 10 with John Major. And one day, Major comes down from the flat upstairs for a meeting, and he is white as chalk, looks absolutely hellish, and Gummer thinks he's going to die. And then he starts to think, what would actually happen now in the middle of our current political crisis, because there was always a current political crisis during the Major years, what happens if the Prime Minister dies? And he thought, well, what would actually happen is Michael Heseltine would arrive in the room and say, absolutely impossible, can't happen, he's not dead, we'll just have to put him on side for that, to carry on. On we go. And you think, well, so how long could you hide the death of a prime minister during a crisis if you really wanted to? And he thought that would make a good novel, but he's not a novelist. So eventually he was put in touch with me by another mutual friend. And I thought, well, I could turn that into a novel.
Excellent.
One thing that comes across very clearly, I think, in the book is how well you know both the subject area of which you talk about, but also how well you know the different locations. For example, Number 10 Downing Street, a place I imagine you've frequented a lot during your career.
I've been there a lot. I have to say the current PM, David Cameron, was kind enough to let me in to prowl around because I wanted it to be up to date. So I've now seen the private rooms, what his kitchen, which features in the book, looks like. Where the potential corridors leading to underground passages may be, and all of that stuff. So I have cased the joint fairly thoroughly.
I'm glad to hear it. And a second novel on the way, I understand.
Second novel, yes, it's written, it's gone to the publishers, and it is as rude about the Labour Party as this is about where the right in politics.
Well, you have to be balanced at all times,
absolutely,
don't you?
Absolutely, BBC and all that
stuff. Of course.
Yeah, definitely.
It would be remiss of me to have you on and not ask after your health. You seem to have made a remarkable recovery.
Do you know what? It's been a very good 2015 so far. I didn't drink a drop of alcohol in January, lost a stone, and
well,
I'm just feeling stronger, and I'm going to the gym more, and it's a long process. My arm is still pretty much useless, my left arm. And I sort of weave and hobble rather than walk. But, you know, I'm getting stronger all the time. can't complain.
No, absolutely. It must have changed you as a person. I mean, to go through something like that. I mean, you know, I've read lots of interviews you've done in which you say, you know, your family were told, you know, you might not make it.
Oh yes, there were several days when they thought I would make it, and that if I did make it, I'd be basically a cabbage in a wheelchair. So I was very lucky not to happen.
Yeah.
And did it change me? You always like to think that a great big life event like that will change you completely. And the honest truth is, it hasn't changed me as much as I thought it was going to. I went through a good year when I had lost most of my ambition, and I spent more time sort of staring at the sun going down and inhaling the flower scent and so forth than I would have done before. But I'm now back to overworking and charging around. That seems to be my nature, my temperament, and
thing.
I can't escape it.
No.
And Andrew, just bringing it back to the book, am I right in thinking you wrote this during your recovery?
Yes. Almost all of it during the recovery. Part of the recovery where I couldn't do much. I was more or less pinned to a sofa. So
Can you not say, when you couldn't do much, you wrote a novel, since that's what I make a living out of?
Yeah.
That's been a very bad line. Sorry.
Well, it's not.
But I know what you mean. But I actually wanted my comment on Head of State, as it very much put me in mind of David Lodge, and I think we could even go as far as to say Evelyn Waugh. That kind of very strong satiricism, looking at things we really actually shy away from a lot and don't want to look at. I mean, I came away gasping, actually, thinking, please, God, don't let it be that awful. And you said, this is the life you are part of, you live in. And I suppose one of the things you were perhaps trying to do was open the eyes of the rest of us.
Yes, and thank you for your comments about David Lodge and Evelyn Waugh.
Yes,
along
without
with
the
Graham Greene are the greatest... fiction writers, I think, of the 20th century in English. I just think they're wonderful. So
yes, you've definitely got their sort of biting edge, and you can see that they're your influence.
That's really kind. Coming back to the kind of the world that I'm trying to describe, it's a difficult one because people do behave abominably, but then people behave abominably in ordinary office politics as well, the struggle for the top and all the rest of it. But what I also want to kind of convey is that politics isn't about nothing. These are also people who, at one level, are in it for the best motives. You know, they want to make Britain better or stronger.
Yes.
In this particular one, there's a bunch of people who want to take Britain out of the EU for the best reasons, and another bunch of people who are determined that Britain should stay in. And so I'm always trying to weave together the idealism. And, you know, I know lots of politicians who spend days and days and days of the average week working to help people who've got mental health problems, or they've gone bankrupt, or they've lost their business because they've been diddled, or something like that. Really, really grindingly unglamorous hard work to help other people. And we have to remember that when we're seeing them also as kind of liars and frauds and con people and all the rest of it. It's a very, very weird mixture of oil and water stuck together in the same personalities.
That's actually genuinely always been my view. I don't think anybody goes into politics without, initially at least, the want of the greater good. And I do think that gets forgotten.
Well, I'm glad you say that. I mean, if you wanted simply to have power and lots of money, then it's much quicker to make lots of money
there are easier ways.
Yes, go to a bank, go to a blue chip, yeah.
Absolutely. I always say to people, if you're thinking of going into politics, think first of all that there's a good more than 50% chance that you will choose the party that isn't in power at the time. So you're a kind of backbench cipher, and that's not much fun. And then if you're in power, you probably got a 1 in 10 chance of getting into the government. And then once you're in the government, you've probably got another 1 in 10 chance of getting into the cabinet, and you've got a very much higher chance of being sacked from your job very, very quickly. In disgrace, with the entire country pointing the finger and laughing at you.
Yeah.
It's
in fact,
really
it's a wonder anybody goes
option.
Into it at all, really, after that summary,
I know,
Andrew.
I know.
You've always had a strong interest in politics, though, haven't you? I was reading that you once wrote to the Chinese embassy whilst you were at school. Is that true?
That's shamefully true. I was a very strange little boy. I went, in my defence, I went to a very, very authoritarian boarding school when I was 8 or 9, and by the time I was 10, I decided, just reading the newspapers, that I quite liked the idea of the Maoists, because they sent all the professors to work in the fields.
Right.
And a very good thing to do with teachers, to me.
Clever.
And all of that. And so, yes, I wrote to the Chinese embassy in London, I'm going to start a cell of the Chinese Communist Party at this school.
As you do. How old were you at the
time? Did you get a response?
I think I was about 11.
Right.
And they did. It was amazing, because somebody got the letter and sent me back a great big parcel of about 50 or 60 copies of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book in plastic
wrappers.
Fabulous.
I hope you've still got a few copies of that.
No, they all went to the time. I distributed them among the innocent children of
Christ
at the time.
Brilliant. Vanessa is in Guildford. She's got in touch on the text line to say, Andrew, why did you want to write Head of State? Was it because it gave you an opportunity to say things that you'd actually been itching to say for years but that you couldn't have got away with as a BBC journalist?
That is pretty much exactly
right.
Why. I couldn't have put it better myself. I mean, you know, as a journalist, you accumulate real-life stories that you can't actually use because they're not relevant to the political story of the day, or because they're too rude, or because they're libelous.
Mm.
And you watch people operating. You watch how chief whips talk to ministers who are in trouble. And it's just jaw-dropping. And I thought, I want to get some of this. This is all fascinating information about the way we're really governed. I can't do it in the BBC News report, so let's stick it into a novel.
Yeah. One thing that always strikes me when I watch you on a Sunday morning, when you give a politician a real grilling, you know, you haul them over the coals, what is it like when the camera stops? I mean, are they quite pleasant with you, or have they got, you know, are they really fed up with you and got the right hump? I mean, how does that work?
You can never tell. You can sense during the interview if somebody is really cross. Most politicians, because it's what they do for a living partly, is having disobliging interviewers going at them, are perfectly polite afterwards, usually stay for breakfast, and then you'll find all the little cross currents over breakfast. You'll find Nigel Farage and Ed Miliband chatting away together.
It must just be so bizarre.
Very bizarre.
Would you like a pan of chocolat, Nigel?
Exactly. And what do you think is really going on in the Kent constituencies at the moment? Well, and so on. So no, there's a lot of that goes on. You do occasionally, people get genuinely angry. But I think what I try to do is ask people reasonable, pointed questions that the ordinary voter would want to be asked.
Yeah.
And ask the questions politely, with a certain amount of respect in my voice. I'm not trying to sneer at them or jibe them. But if they refuse to answer, I make that absolutely clear and keep on going for as long as I can without boring the viewer. And I think if you do it like that, keep eye contact, keep a smile on your face, and ask the really hard, direct questions. Very few politicians take offence.
Mm. And you're far too professional to name names as to the ones who do go storming off.
You took the words out of my mouth. Afraid so.
In the book, you dedicate the novel to Harry Cameron Marr.
That's my son. Yes, that's right. That's my oldest child. He works in the East London kind of geek world.
Right.
I guess they're all geeks and they all work 18 hours a day. Yeah.
He must be very proud of his dad.
He would never say so,
well,
I think.
Of course not. You don't tell your dad you're proud of them, do you?
And he's chosen a way of life working. He's a techie. He writes code and works for a startup that's doing very well, which is so totally alien to the world of politics that I think, you know, that's... says it all.
You put him off, well done.
He's had far too much politics ranted at him around the kitchen table, so...
Interestingly, in the book, I feel that you're not only sort of airing the dirty linen of the political world, but you're also raising an eyebrow to the British public and saying, you really ought to get more involved, you ought to care a little bit more. Were you trying to say that? Do you despair that the vast majority don't even... well, many don't turn up to the polling stations at all, and the vast majority are not engaged day to day.
I think it's sad, and I think we journalists are partly responsible. If we tell people that, you know, everything in politics is corrupt and a lie and rubbish, and you can't believe a word anyone ever says, why would people turn
Quite.
On and listen? But the great counterexample in my recent political lifetime is, of course, the Scottish referendum, where it was a very straightforward choice in Britain or outside the UK. The arguments were made strongly and passionately, and there were arguments about tax and fairness and can we survive alone and the EU and all the rest of it. And virtually everybody got involved.
Yes.
And it wasn't just that there was a very, very high percentage of people voting, though there was. It was also, I went up there a lot, and I'd be in a Edinburgh tea shop or whatever it might be, and you would find people having really passionate political discussions across the buns and coffees. or in the pub or in the street, and the whole country got involved. So when politics really seems to matter to people.
Quite. And this there's a lot to lose or gain, depending on your viewpoint.
Exactly.
And everybody, yes. Which I think is entirely what the book's about, because the debate is in or out of Europe.
And that's probably coming to a polling booth near you before too long. You know? it's on its way, I think, that referendum, one way or another. So, and at that point, I think people really will take, you know, take notice.
Yes, and your sales will soar.
Well,
and people will be terrified.
Here's hoping.
If they read this, they'll be terrified.
Yes. Well, I've tried to balance it reasonably. The those who want Britain to leave the EU are in this book led by a psycho woman, really. A kind of mash-up of
Lydia Kite,
and
yes.
A dominatrix kind of figure. on the other hand, giving away a little bit of plot, they win. So I think I've been balanced to both sides.
And there's some fabulous illustrations as well in the book.
Well, thank you very much. I draw for a hobby.
Yeah.
Paint and draw for a hobby. So I thought there are so many characters here, people may get confused as to who's who. So I'll draw them as I envisage them in my mind's eye, and that might help.
I particularly liked as well the radio call-in show featured, for obvious reasons.
Well, indeed.
And Red Dwight from Pinner called
Red
in.
Red Dwight, yes. Red, we know who you are.
Absolutely. But yeah. It's a very funny book. It's a very interesting book. It's called Head of State, written by Andrew Marr. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for a very enjoyable conversation. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.